be different. I got a really good feeling about it this year.
Well, hello there, friends and neighbors. This is Dan Cavallari, Slow Guy on the Fast Ride, coming at you with another Slow Guy on the Fast Ride podcast. And today, I have a very special guest joining me today, all the way from sunny, warm, hopefully warm California, is Mr. Phil Guymon. Phil, how's it going?
Great. It's currently 48 degrees, but it'll get up to 72. So one of those, like, you start riding at 11:30 and you're good to go.
Yeah. Well, if anybody that has listened to this podcast before knows that I record out here in my garage, and so I'm constantly just shivering through these. So, you know, the last time, Phil, I talked to you for a podcast, you were wearing your bathrobe, and I just encouraged you to put your bathrobe back on. And I like the consistency here.
I was naked, and then you're like, no, please put the bathrobe on. Please.
For God's sakes.
I live in the bathrobe when I can.
Yeah. Well, and the funny thing is, Phil, I think that was before COVID. So, you know, you were ahead of the curve, you know, just wearing the bathrobe all day.
I used to bring a bathrobe to races because a lot of times, like at races, there's a lot of hotel hallway action from the massage room and the food room, all that stuff. And I would travel with a bathrobe. And a few guys copied me, at least at the time. I don't know if it caught on, but I was the first.
I think we just stumbled upon your next cookie product. I think it's a cookie bathrobe.
If there was any way to tie it in, I've been trying to find a bathrobe sponsor for a long time. I got Decathlon as like a casual clothing sponsor. They do make, it's not a bathrobe, it's like for swim sports, but it's a robe. So I should have worn that. It's got the logos and everything on it. So I do have a branded bathrobe. But it's not exactly a bathrobe sponsor. Anyway, that's one of my white whales.
I would buy that for sure. Phil, the reason we're chatting today is because, well, you know, first of all, I like to catch up with you every once in a while. But, you know, we were watching, I'm talking about myself as the royal we. That's a good start to the podcast. I was watching your YouTube channel, which is always full of entertaining stuff. And recently you did a piece with Alex Howes and Kiel Reinen, and it was called Kill Phil. And I wanted to talk about this because, first of all, the video is great. I watched it. You should all watch it. It's great, great, great piece of cinema. But tell me about how it came about. You know, I know you and Howes were, and I think you and Kiel were also teammates, or were you teammates, or just buddies in the peloton?
I was teammates with Kiel on Jelly Belly approximately 11 million years ago.
Right.
It was us and then three dinosaurs. and then, yeah, Alex for a couple of years on Garmin Sharp and Cannondale. And we've all stayed in touch. Those are a few of my favorites. I've collected a select group of bike racers that I still love and maintain relationships with, and vice versa, who will put up with me also.
Sure. They're like your cycling NFTs. It's a nice little collection. Yeah. But you know, Kiel just, he retired recently, and you happen to be sort of the pro of retiring. So talk a little bit about the video, how it came about, and what advice you had for Kiel in his retirement.
Yeah, it was actually, I'll give the credit. It was Alex's idea. It was, he called me up and he was, I guess I was trying to get Alex into content. I think what I've been doing, I'm going to go on three tangents, but what I'm doing in, you know, leaving racing and focusing on content, I'm going to give myself some credit in that it's harder than it looks. It's one thing to like do a ride. It's hard to make a video. It's hard to edit. It's hard to like find your own sponsors, all that stuff. But I do think I've been telling Alex for a long time, like you're the one of the guys who could do this. There's not a lot who could do it, I think, or who'd want to go through the work. But I think Alex would nail it. Kiel as well. They're both like kind of naturally funny, kind of storytellers. And I've been telling both of them, and both of them this year sort of are forced to agree with me. Just with Alex's. I'm not sure what his exact, he's a coach on EF. I don't know if he's going to race road. Like he might do the Tour de France and Dirty Kansa for all I know, but whatever it's called now, Unbound. But I'm not sure. But I think both of them are going to be doing more content than they have for their sponsors and teams. Kiel is racing no longer for Trek Factory Racing, or maybe it's Trek Factory Racing, but gravel branded. So he's still with Trek in some form, but doing a gravel schedule, and a lot of that is going to be social media and content based. So I think both of them were just in like, A, having a good time, B, getting in shape. It's been cold wherever they are. Keel's up in near Seattle. Alex up in Ned, so even colder than where you are.
Right.
And then so it was kind of that combined, and then let's get a taste of content. So Alex called me and was like, okay, have you ever done anything with the idea of kill Phil? And I was like, go on. That was the first thing. I was like, yeah, he came up with, basically we both just made him deal with the routes and the logistics, which meant that none of that really took place. And it was like, a lot of it was just on the phone during the ride. He's like, I think we're going to stay in this town tonight. And it worked out. It was always right on the verge of, so the idea for people who aren't aware, Kill Phil, Alex and Keel flew here. They brought their gravel bikes. We drove out kind of into the Nevada border area and, basically just did like some epic rides on, sand, and there's a fair bit of hiking and roads that I'm not comfortable with and wouldn't call roads and hiking trails and point to point, kind of crazy. We were just out there from 9 to 5 every day, just riding our bikes and having a good time and having a certain amount of bad time and that balance. So that was the Kill Phil video, was two old pros trying to kill me, and how that went. It was 4 days. It ended up being a great time. It was mostly just filmed with my selfie stick. And I had a buddy kind of come out to take photos and follow us in the support car. So it wasn't just basically as a you know, stopgap.
Yeah.
So we didn't get Alex and freeze to death in the desert.
Well, so they didn't succeed in killing you. I mean, you're here to live another day in your bathrobe, sure. But, you know, obviously even in retirement, you've stuck mostly to road. I mean, was this your first big gravel excursion, or do you ride gravel fairly regularly, or what's your relationship with gravel? Cause it seems like that's the retirement du jour for pro cyclists right now.
Yeah. I think, I don't know. I always say like I was riding gravel when gravel was called dirt. I got into riding in Georgia and Florida. Actually Gainesville, Florida, I've said this before, Gainesville, Florida, where I went to college, University of Florida, was like one of the very early scenes in gravel, riding. There was a group ride there called like the Lime Rock ride that I never did at the time, but, kind of a bunch of like the, you know, outside of the older than the college people, the local kind of townies, we're doing these group rides. There's really cool dirt in that part of the country. Here it's a lot like the honestly, the dirt roads in North Central Florida are better than the paved roads in LA in a lot of parts. you go out there and it just makes it safer. It was low speed. And because the terrain in Florida is obviously super flat and boring, it made it more interesting. So yeah, I used to train on, you know, 23C tires and gravel and road. We just called it dirt roads back in the day. We would try to stick to dirt roads as much as we could, just for like base miles. And then got into road, stuck to road. In retirement, once kind of the gravel scene blew up, I tried a couple races and I was sort of already really into the whole angle of content more than racing. Racing was just so dead for me when I stopped and I had a good momentum by the time, you know, I did the Belgian waffle ride a couple of times, but I was just like, I definitely didn't like it enough to put more effort into it. So I'm not against, like, I enjoy riding gravel. I probably do it once in a while, but also where I am is like one of the best places in North America for road riding. The weather's perfect. There's just incredible canyons everywhere. There's good gravel here too. But it's not a problem. So I still do it.
So you're not doing the transition to gravel like a lot of pros, but it's something you like for the story, basically.
If I can have an adventure on it, I'm into it. I don't hate riding on trails. Put it that way.
Not the worst. So tell me, I guess during the course of that video and filming it, highlights and lowlights. I mean, you know, I've ridden with Alex before, and he's no joke. I've ridden with you before, and you've torn my legs off too. So, you know, these are guys that are just either still racing or just coming, out of racing. And you've been out for a few years, but you've been staying incredibly active and doing some incredibly challenging riding. So, did you still feel like you were, at that level, the elite level, or, you know, was it eye opening for you to see any change, or what was that like kind of just riding with the guys who are still fresh in that?
Yeah. It's funny. Like I kind of made a point to, I try to ride with pros as much as I can. Cause you just forget how hard they train. Mm-hmm. For the first couple years of my retirement, like I didn't have to train that hard. I would just go for 2 KOMs a week, do the group ride and do like one long ride. Mm-hmm. And that was kind of enough. And I would sort of maintain my power and it was fine. Now it's a little bit more work. I'm actually on like an interval training plan, but hilarious, like seeing the improvements. It's just, you know, like what I did for 4 minutes last week, I could do 5 for 5 minutes this week. So you get back into it. So no, I'm certainly not at the level that I was like in 2015, 2016. But I was also benefited by Alex and Kiel. We're both coming out of their off seasons. Kiel just had a baby. Alex just broke his pinky. So it was kind of the worst they've been in a few years. Mm-hmm. And so when it went uphill, I was ahead of them. And especially like the last couple days, they were kind of in the box, and SoCal is beneficial for that. But there were also a few moments, like skills wise, they're ahead of me on gravel. Like I just don't have the miles. So there was a couple spots where like I was walking and they were waiting for me. Mm-hmm. And then there were a few moments too. There's like one day where it's just like this horrible crosswind at the beginning, and Kiel went to the front, and I was like, God, I'm like at the Tour of Qatar. It was just sandy. And I just like Kiel on his worst day, he has that in him of just being on the front in this. And I was quite miserable.
Yeah.
Just,
yeah. I got miserable kind of listening to that. That
yeah. You really realize like the pedigree of those guys and like just what they can do off the couch is pretty insane.
Yeah, and that's an interesting question. So I did an interview with Ruth Winder a few months ago, and you know, she had just retired and was actually having a little bit of trouble sort of untraining, as she put it, you know, sort of, you know, you get into that lifestyle of the pro, which is get up, ride insane amounts of miles, race, you're used to sort of that schedule and that punishing brutality in your body, and it becomes second nature to you. When you retired, was it hard to untrain your body and get out of the mentality? I mean, you really kind of haven't, right? Like you're still training pretty hard, but was it hard to sort of untrain your body so that you were used to civilian life, as it were?
That's what I was going to say. I honestly, like, I totally understand what Ruth's talking about. And found a way to dodge it. So I have not had to experience that yet. I did the full, like when I realized I was done racing and wasn't at this point, like my sponsorships are still pretty much, or in many ways, dependent on my fitness. So like I still train as much as I can and try to be in the best shape I can. I do consider that my job, on top of the content and everything else. That I'm not sure if I would, like, most of my videos are me going for really difficult KOMs. If I went a year and missed all of them, I'm not sure how that would look to my audience or my sponsors. So, you know, I try to stay there, but when I stopped, before I knew that YouTube was kind of my existence, I did take like a month off, completely. And I was trying to find other physical activities that I liked just to be in shape. I was supposed to get like a desk job at that point. So I was like, okay, what can I, you know, let's see what an hour long workout looks like. Cause normally you don't even get started on the bike. Like 3 hours is when you start your intervals at the previous level. And now so I was swimming and doing weights. And you know, it was a month. It wasn't enough for like my body to, I guess, get used to it, but boy, did I hate it. So I guess if I had advice for like the Roos out there, it's, you know, more riding, less training. So just like being out there and not like thinking about power or heart rate or whatever, but just like, so now the way I handle is I'll just go for a ride, and you know, I have a lot of phone calls. I still have, you know, sponsored, I have work. But I try to plan that around like coffee shops. So I'll like ride for 2 hours. Here's the middle of my ride. I'm going to stop and like do work for a couple hours and then go home. I don't know. It doesn't make much sense.
But you found a way.
Yeah. I just try to be like, being outside is kind of the critical part, I think, that people miss if you just go from like, you know, 20 hours a week on the bike to a desk. That's going to be a shock.
Yeah. I mean, honestly, even just as somebody, I never was even remotely close to being a pro, just wrote a lot, and tapering off of that was, you know, not pleasant. I mean, you can feel it physically in your body. You can feel your legs sort of aching almost from right. not being used. And the idea of sitting a lot is just, it's difficult. So yeah, I mean, it's a hard transition, and I think you've done it effectively, which, we're going to take a quick break, but after we come back, I do want to talk about how you've made this work and, you know, sort of the idea of cyclists now having to be more than just cyclists. And we're going to talk a little bit about Jeff Kubusch's piece in Cycling Tips about that very topic. We're going to take a quick break. We'll dive right back into that in just a moment. All right, we are back with Slow Guy on the Fast Ride podcast. My guest is Phil Guymon, and you all know him probably from a lot of his videos on YouTube. And if you've been following long enough, you know also that he was a pro cyclist for many years and did some pretty killer races. But Phil, it's interesting now because, you know, you've got a pretty impressive resume. You know, you're a former pro cyclist, you are an author, you are basically a YouTube star, as it were. Recently, Jeff Kubusch, who I'll actually be interviewing later this week for this podcast, recently wrote a piece for Cycling Tips about what it takes to be a pro cyclist today. And often that means not just being fast on a bike. It means also having sort of that social media savvy and being able to market yourself. And is that something that we want? And I think there's two sides to that coin, of course. I mean, one is that it sort of democratizes access to being an elite athlete or even just a personality. And I think you exemplify that well with what you've been able to do post-career. But also the other side of that is it takes away from being able to train and focus on being an athlete. And also it calls on you to maybe, if you're not into that sort of thing and don't want to be that personality, now you have to be. And so that's adding to the workload of an athlete. So I want to talk a little bit about that because you've been incredibly successful building your persona after your career. Do you find that sort of new paradigm to be useful, to be good, to be healthy, or can it be problematic as well?
I think it can be all those things, which I think Jeff would sort of agree with. I liked his article because he also talked about a lot of the problems kind of fit with gravel racing currently. There's sort of the inclusivity, exclusivity factor. So he sort of brought that into to the specific social media aspect. But I thought, like, bigger picture, his article I really agreed with of gravel. At least it seemed that his thesis was gravel has, I always call it just growing pains. I think it's almost a legitimate sporting thing right now. But there's this combination of like, hey, we're fun. We have beers, you know, we're not too uptight. We don't have drug testing. It's not a big deal, but it's also, we're leveraging pros for an audience and we're leveraging brands for sponsorship and we're calling it a race. And they're kind of having it both ways, that either you're legit in your sporting event, in which case, like, I want separate starts for women. I want drug testing. I want, you know, rules that aren't,
yeah, right.
aren't just enforced on Twitter after the fact. Or you're fun and then you don't know who won. That's my fondo. I can't tell you who won Phil's cookie fondo because it doesn't matter. And that's not part of it. And so I think gravel is kind of on this weird teeter-totter thing that we're just watching and it's a bit clunky and they're figuring it out. And I thought Jeff worded that well, and I was like, I'm glad I don't have to say it because he said it. But yeah, getting back to your point, I think social media is tricky. When I got into riding, I had an English degree and I signed a Jelly Belly, and I was like, well, I want to do something with this degree. So I started writing a blog for Bicycling Magazine, and it also ended up paying the bills for the first few years. You know, it wasn't pretty, but it worked with a lot of that stuff. And I think that was sort of the beginning of that turned into basically Instagram. And after the fact, Now YouTube is just, you know, it wasn't social media, it was just like sharing a story. And I remember the first time I was paid like a living wage to ride for a team, it was Bissell. And I was just so appreciative to make $45,000 a year to race a bike that like, I wanted to sell vacuums. And it wasn't seriously, I was just like, I can't believe they're letting me do this thing. Like, I'm going to tweet about, this was before Instagram was really a big deal. I'm going to tweet about vacuums all the time. And I'm going to like, ironically try to sell vacuums. They made me a code and I was like integrating vacuums into everything I could. And it was fun. But I also like, it was, no one ever done that on that team. And like, why am I the crazy one for trying to get a return on the investment for sponsors? So that's the thing is like, I guess I didn't get the impression that Jeff was really bemoaning the social media aspect specifically, but like, if you want to have this lifestyle where you're supported by brands and by fans, then kind of like, you have to make it worth their while, unless you have a trust fund I don't know about. Mm-hmm. So I never see that as a thing. Where it gets tricky is the rich get richer. So if you're a brand and it makes a lot more sense to sponsor me, who whatever Instagram followers I have after I've gone racing, than someone who's kind of coming up. And the question is like, what is the path of people who are coming up now, in really in any discipline? But I think the, you know, there's going to have to be a next generation. There are people winning small races and, you know, junior races, stuff like that. And they're going to have to, you know, bang their fist through the whatever, just the same way we did,
right?
As kids. So that, yeah, I think it's complicated now. Mm-hmm. But I don't see it as a problem. My thing was I was kicked out of the World Tour at 30. You know, Pete was similar, not kicked out, might not be appropriate for him, but not the right place for him to be. Pete Stetton I'm talking about. And mm-hmm. But I think Ted King is a good example too. Like, you know, Ted and I were competing for jobs for years. And it was funny, like I always beef with him a little bit. Like I just was not a fan of Ted, because we were just going, you know, we're the marketable American who has a blog. And it was one of those, like, you know, when Cannondale, I was on Garmin Sharp, he was on Cannondale, those teams merged and only one of us could be there. And I always resented him for it because he got that spot. And I actually texted him a few weeks ago. I sent a message. I was like, hey, I realized like, we're still doing this 5 years later. There should have been room for both of us. Like, we shouldn't have been competing. Like, obviously we still belong, by the fact that like, I'm getting paid multiples of what I was racing in the World Tour. That's a failure of the World Tour more than anything else, that I'm more valuable to brands here than I was there. And I think all of us are just kind of navigating that in our own weird ways, but it's certainly honest. And I deserve to be here. I am. That's the nature of it. And I'm still able to drop Alex and Keel on a hill, you know, albeit in their off season, but I can do it. Mm-hmm. 5 years retired. So why should the only validity for fitness be in this competition?
Right. Is this a uniquely American situation? I mean, are European pros, you know, dealing, or even retired pros sort of in your mold, essentially, are they having to deal with the same things, or is this sort of a uniquely American problem because cycling has been on the decline in the US for so long?
I think it's more American just because, yeah, the road racing scene isn't what it was when I stopped. So when I was coming up, there was this vibrant scene of, you know, the Tour de Tuna. There was, I probably did 80 race days a year of like local races, and I made a fair living, not a fair living, but I paid the bills at 23 on prize money for the most part. You know, you go to like a race in Florida, a Saturday, Sunday in mid February, and I'd come home with $1,200, after the weekend. And that stuff for the most part isn't there anymore. And so that was there for you on the way up, and it was kind of, you know, you had to pay your dues, but for the most part, it was a ladder you could climb. And then it was also there for you on the way down. So a guy coming off of, you know, Discovery, a Pat McCarty, would do a couple years on Bissell. Maybe he just did one, but he and I were teammates on Bissell when he came down from World Tour. And, you know, that's probably where I would be if it existed. And Pete as well, but there's that's not there anymore. And that's another separate podcast. I'm not sure who to blame that for. That's a lot of factors of what happened to American racing. So in Europe, I think the racing is cooler there. Like road racing is cooler there. It's not like you have to invent a discipline. And they do have the middle tier and the, you know, like Greipel's going to have a team as long as he wants to race. And it won't affect his life. And he can do, you know, the Kermesses, and you can also like get appearance fees, stuff like that there, for those kind of guys. So I think I'm sure it's happening, and I know they're keeping an eye on what's happening here. You know, Lawrence Tendam is he's a pig in shit in the gravel scene. And he could be over there doing that if he wanted to. He might be, well, he's definitely unique, put it that way. Yeah. I would say less so.
Yeah. Also I guess another question is, you know, if you say you didn't have as big of a presence on YouTube and build all the things that you've already built, would you see gravel as an opportunity for you to continue doing what you do or to build what you were doing post race career? I mean, would you have a different perspective on gravel if you were not in the position you're in already based on what you, I mean, you retired kind of at a time when gravel wasn't ready,
right?
You know,
right. I don't think I've changed my vision on gravel. I don't need gravel is my position. Mm-hmm. But I think like gravel is definitely a viable, you know, if these guys look at, okay, you know, I could do, you know, making up numbers, like I could do 60 race days a year and I could live on one continent while my wife lives on another continent and the baby lives over there. And I could have, you know, I could race down mountains in the rain, and dodge crashes and not know what my schedule is next week and make $65,000. Or, I could live at home and do 12 race days a year and some content and still like work hard and stay in shape, with gravel. Like it's kind of a no brainer in a lot of cases. And I'm sure it's going to get more competitive for that reason. Mm-hmm. But I also think it's insanely top heavy. I don't know if it's a real thing for like, I want to be a pro gravel racer at 23. Like, I'm not sure. I don't know what those kids are supposed to do. I guess I'll put it that way. That's complicated. I hope that gets sort of sorted out.
Yeah. And that's like
not everyone can retire and focus on Strava and YouTube. Like, I don't know if there's room for more people having YouTube channels about KLMs. Like,
it's, right, right.
So there's a creativity element that other guys will figure out other things, but gravel's there.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I'm going to ask you one totally off the wall question. Now, you have a video on your YouTube channel, which I have not watched, but I want to watch it as soon as we hang up here. And it's the pro cyclist arm wrestling between you and Tom Skoinch.
Oh yeah.
I got to ask who won.
Oh, that obviously Tom's won.
Yeah. No offense, but it looks like two stick figures holding their arms
up. Well, that was what I thought. So this was a funny one. This was that idea came from like last summer when it was Jake Paul fought Floyd Mayweather.
Yeah.
And it was like a bigger pay-per-view event than like Jake. The best way to make money if you're a boxer right now is to fight Jake Paul, which is, so like, there's a lot of parallels to cycling of just like, that's a failure to the pro sport of boxing, as much as success of Jake Paul. But I think, and I was trying to figure out like, okay, why does this work? Like, what are the elements that makes this work? And the answer is you want to click on it because you want to know what happened. And you care about Jake Paul. You care about the people involved. You know, either you hate him or you like him. You want to see him lose. You want to see him win. And I was like, okay, how can I translate that? Obviously without having to like get in a fight, cause that's not going to work. Pro cyclist fighting you would click on that.
No doubt.
So I switched to arm wrestling, and Tom's it was perfect because Tom's was visiting and didn't want to ride. They did went on a little road trip, and he came through here and like didn't. Mm-hmm. He had a bike, but wasn't interested in training. So I was like, all right, I got to do a video with Tom's. But nobody really clicked on it. So I would say my theory failed. I think it got some views, but not what I'd hoped. And you know, we could have hyped it more. But I would say that was in my head that was going to be a series, and it's more of a one and done.
Yeah.
But it's there.
That's too bad. That's that. I mean, like, I'm just looking
at the video's funny.
Yeah. I mean, I'm looking at your YouTube page right now, and that's the one I want to click on immediately.
Yeah. I think you've got to, maybe you just got to be more of a bike dork. Like you've got to be at our level than a, just a random, let's see, cyclist. Yeah.
That's a high level of dork. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Phil, before we wrap up, Phil's Fondo, is it happening this year? What's the story?
Fingers crossed. I don't want to say it's happening until the permits are done. But I don't see why not. They're having like 10,000 person marathons in LA County now. But it's Malibu is notorious for, you know, they're a peaceful beach community. They don't want our riffraff in there. So we have to fight them most years anyway and pay them exorbitant amounts for the road closures. Right. But I think it should happen. We'll keep that going. We're also going to start a gravel event. I'm pretty sure this, not too long from now, it'll be smaller. So I don't have to worry about starting but not in LA County. Cause I don't want to deal with LA County anymore, but we're going to have a cool gravel event, not a gravel race. I'm not going to know who won. I think the success of Phil's Cookie Fondo was I went to some fondos and I was like, why is this a race? I've been doing races. This is a fondo. This should feel different.
Yeah.
So I started a fondo that, you know, you want to stop at the aid stations because there's cookies and there's games and there's fun shit to do and people to hang out with.
Yeah.
So I want to push that into the gravel scene too. And just like, I'm going to have a nice gravel ride and you're going to all have fun and we're not going to keep score. So nice. We'll work on that too.
And if people want to keep track and see when that gets announced, is philthethrill.net the place to go?
Philsfondo.com is probably better for that. Yeah, I've got
great
people helping with that one.
And on social media, you're very active. Where can people find you there?
At Phil Guymon anywhere. If you want to see me ranting about politics, it's Twitter. If you want to know about bikes, it's Instagram. Twitter is my outlet. I have sponsors who like they're the deliverable sheet to be like one Instagram post per month, two tweets. I'm like, you don't be on my Twitter. I'm happy to tweet your thing, but you know,
It's a little more complicated.
YouTube, Phil Guymon. It's easy. People Google it. It's there.
Yeah. Yeah. If you Google Phil Guymon, you'll find all that stuff pretty easily. Phil, thanks for taking the time today. I do appreciate it as always. And, I'm glad to see that you've stayed consistent with the bathrobe. I hope next time we talk, you'll have the bathrobe again. Maybe I'll get one too. And we'll just, it'll be our bathrobe chats.
It'll work.
Yeah. It's perfect. Yeah. All right. Chilly out here. I need something to warm me up. Phil, thanks again. And if you guys have questions for me, you can get me at Slow Guy Fast Ride on Twitter, at Slow Guy on the Fast Ride on Instagram. And of course, you can go to slowguyonthefastride.com to sign up for the newsletter. Check out all the great content I am pushing out these days. And I would love it if you go to my YouTube channel as well and check out all the videos that I'm doing. They're not as funny and entertaining as Phil's, but hopefully they are useful to you if you are into bicycles and bike tech. And lots of cool interviews. So that's where you can find me. If you have questions for Phil, you can reach out to him on social media, or I am happy to pester Phil anytime, so you can reach out to me as well. Thank you all for listening today, and we'll catch you on the next episode of the Slow Guy on the Fast Ride podcast.
Oh yeah, this'll be a good year, you'll see.